Hello, good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, depending where you are. I'm Dr. Nizam Damani, speaking from Geneva, and I work at the WHO, so it's evening time over here, but I know New York time will be afternoon. So I will be chairing the session, and as you know, the title of today's WHO teleclass is Highlights on Surgical Site Infections Prevention, the New CDC Guidelines, and More. It is really my great honor and privilege to introduce to you Professor Joe Solomkin, who will deliver today's presentation. After completing his undergraduate degree from Harvard University, he pursued his medical education at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York. After serving 2 years in the U.S. military, he returned to his surgical training at the University of Minnesota Hospitals, and then served as surgeon at the Kapanga Hospital in Zaire. On his return to the United States, he joined the Department of Surgery at the University of Cincinnati Medical Center as a general surgeon, subspecializing burns and trauma, and Joe is the recognized international authority on infection in surgical site. Since becoming Professor Emeritus in 2009, he continues his clinical work at the University of Cincinnati Medical Center and worked in the Antimicrobial Stewardship Program and the Surgical Care Improvement Project. He's involved in several guideline projects, including work with the CDC, FDA, and WHO. I'm delighted to say that he is also our current chair of the new WHO guideline group on the prevention of surgical site infection. So without further ado, I will hand over to Joe. Thank you.
Nizam, thank you. That was a very kind introduction. And I would just say it's a great pleasure to be working with Nizam and his colleagues at WHO. And it's also a pleasure to be presenting this information to you regarding preventing surgical site infections, and then particularly referencing the updated U.S. CDC guidelines. I think, as you can see on the title slide, I've placed my email address there. If there are any questions, or if anybody would like a copy of these slides, please simply email me at the address shown, and I will be delighted to forward these or answer your questions. So I first want to get into a little bit of the background of the U.S. CDC guidelines, and they are not, at this point, completely finished. There is a meeting tomorrow that I'll be attending in Atlanta where the final guidelines will be presented. Under U.S. government regulations, proposed guidelines are published in what's known as the Federal Register, and this allows a comment period by all parties interested in this area. That comment period was closed 3 months ago, and the agency responsible for this guideline, the Centers for Disease Control, has been working to respond to and incorporate as needed the comments that were made. So what I'm going to present to you is the version that was published in the website that you see here, www.regulations.gov, and there's a larger version of it. You can find at that location both the guideline itself and then the appendix materials that include such items as the search strategies for the literature review and what are called the grade summaries of the studies that were included in this. I want to back up one step now and discuss the role of guidelines in contemporary health care. And the definition of these guidelines has changed through time. And I would say my first involvement with guidelines goes back to the 1980s. And at that time, guidelines were really viewed as compendia of expert opinion. This partly reflected the relatively small number of randomized controlled trials then, but particularly in surgery, it reflected a mindset of what appropriate opinion to guide practice or appropriate guides for practice would be. Since that time, through the efforts of large numbers of groups and people and regulatory agencies, the definition of guidelines has changed rather dramatically. Now guidelines are considered to be systematically developed, meaning that the relevant experimental background as published in the medical literature becomes the source of the statements and recommendations made. And so the background for this is basically the performance of a systematic review. And now we're fortunate in having not only systematic reviews that have been published, but also meta-analyses that put together high-quality data and attempt to perform statistical analyses supporting various conclusions and recommendations. So the shift then is from away from expert opinion to evidence-based recommendations. The other fact that I think has become fairly clear is that systematically developed guidelines have indeed improved outcomes when they are applied to common and appropriate health care issues. In the United States, the most obvious example of this, even though there's some debate, has to do both with the reduction in surgical site infections and also the reduction in mortality from such common diseases as community-acquired pneumonia in various forms of acute heart disease. In the United States, the guideline compliance is now mandated by the federal government and also by certain state governments, and I'll come back to that in a short time. So if we go on to the next slide, the previous guideline that was generated by the CDC was published in 1999, and this very much fit the model of a guideline stating current expert opinion, but it was also supported by an extensive bibliography of research results that supported many of the recommendations made. This has been a very helpful document, at least within the United States, and has been used externally by other practitioners in countries as a guide to optimal strategies for preventing surgical site infections. If we go on to the next slide, so the question is why it did 15 years after the publication of this, is it now felt to be time for a new update to the guideline? And the primary reason for this really has to do with the enormous increase in the incidence of total joint replacements that's now being conducted in the United States. The number of arthroplasties or joint replacements has been doubling approximately every 7 years. And currently, we estimate that there are between 1.2 million and 1.4 million joint replacements performed in the United States. We estimate that by 2030, only 15 years from now, two doublings will have occurred and that we will be performing approximately 5 million joint replacements. The main driver for this is the appearance of obesity in our population. And the issue really is not the weight bearing on the joint, but rather the metabolic syndromes, particularly the appearance of diabetes, that is responsible for this. We expect that also because of these metabolic syndromes, and again in particular diabetes, that we will see an increased incidence in infection rates. And I would point out that even an infection rate of approximately 2 to 3% will translate into literally hundreds of thousands of infections. And these are very difficult infections to treat. They're associated with very significant disability, morbidity, and even mortality, and also great cost. So it was believed, therefore, that this would be an appropriate time to put together information in two broad areas, one being termed the core, and the other related specifically to arthroplasties. This is slide, if you go to the next graphic, you'll see a curve that actually ended in 2010 predicting the increase in joint replacements. And again, I draw your attention to the doubling time, which here would approximate somewhere between 7 and 9 years. And this actually has turned out to be a somewhat of an underestimate of the increase in the number of procedures performed. How does diabetes cause an infection? In the next graphic or the next slide, you'll see a very technical description of this. But in brief, high blood sugars cause certain cells to produce what are called glycosylation end products. These are released outside of the cell and are sensed as what are termed danger signals and result in a great deal of chronic inflammation. As you know, chronic inflammation reduces the number of bacteria needed to cause an infection, and also specifically in diabetes can lead to considerable joint damage and deformity. So this single pathway, the initiation or the beginning of chronic inflammation in joints is believed to not only cause the joint damage that leads to the requirement for or a decision to perform a joint replacement, but also what we believe to be the increased risk of infection that we see. The next graphic depicts an important additional element that causes or is responsible for infection whenever a prosthetic material is inserted into the body, and that is the formation of biofilms. And what you see here is that certain organisms in very low numbers attached to the surface that has been implanted, and then very specific colony types are formed within the so-called biofilm, both is secreted by the organism. Within this biofilm, the organisms are pretty much non-dividing or divide only slowly, and are generally very much resistant to the action of antibiotics that in other growth forms would kill them readily. So this is a mechanism whereby very low densities of microorganisms can attach to the joint replacement surface and lead to the appearance in, over a very long period of time, of clinical signs of infection, damage to the joint, and ultimately a requirement for some form of intervention, typically removal of the joint. So the question is, going back to the idea of two elements to our guideline, to this updated CDC guideline, one being core changes that apply to all surgical procedures, and then specific changes for recommendations or dealing with arthroplasty. So the first point is that not all patients, not all operations are the same. And therefore, it's very important to have a risk stratification system. And what you see on this graphic, entitled the National Nosocomial Infection Surveillance System Risk Index, is an index that was created several years ago to attempt to identify the risk a group of patients might be at of developing a surgical site infection. And there are really three components to it. The first is an effort at a severity of chronic and acute illness, the so-called ASA, or American Society of Anesthesiologists score. And this score ranges from 0, actually, to 6, where 6 is used primarily for transplant donors. But basically, level 3, 4, and 5 describe patients with very severe and incapacitating or severely limiting chronic background or acute organ failure syndromes. So these represent ultimately a relatively small number of patients undergoing operation in the United States. Furthermore, an additional point is given if the operation is considered contaminated or dirty infected. I would point out that in terms of preventing infections, wounds that are considered heavily contaminated, for example, by unexpected spillage of bowel contents during the procedure, or that are actually infected, these are settings actually for therapy, not for the prophylactic use of antibiotics. Therefore, for most of the procedures that are performed in the United States and other high-income countries, most procedures are actually either clean or clean contaminated. And then the final variable is the duration of the procedure, where for each procedure, a large number of such procedures are surveyed, and the 75th percentile of time needed to perform the procedure is used as a cutoff to give 1 point. So then the NNIS risk score goes from 0 up to 3. So what happens with various operative procedures? Probably the most dramatic is colorectal, which is in small bowel surgery, which even for low-risk patients without severe comorbid disease who have a relatively brief operation without heavy contamination, infection rates in this system can run 4%. As the risk index increases, you can see a steady and significant increase in the infection rates seen. And I would point out that this is now data that's between 10 and 20 years old, and we think that we're doing considerably better. In the next graphic, I want to bring up an important concept that really has changed the way we record and report infections in the United States. This is use of the term complex infections. It's been noticed that superficial surgical site infections are typically not identified in the hospital, and this is particularly true in healthcare systems that focus either on outpatient surgery or on discharging patients relatively rapidly. And that is an important goal of healthcare in the United States, to avoid the problems of prolonged hospitalization, of nosocomial infection and other complications, and also to reduce the cost of healthcare in this particular country. Reporting of these superficial infections, which typically do not cause morbidity and do not require readmission to hospital or treatment with intravenous antibiotics, and rarely require any surgical intervention. Reporting is very spotty. In careful surveys where all patients are followed up, the infection rates, the superficial surgical site infection rates, really double as compared to what we get with our routine surveillance strategies. Since these infections appear to be generally so trivial, to cause so little morbidity and so little disability, we've now decided through the national surveillance system to disregard these infections. So they may still be reported to the CDC, but they are not reported in any public release of data. Rather, we've decided to focus very much in what are called deep incisional and organ space infections. And these generally, in most surveys, amount to approximately a third to a half of the surgical site infections. These are important to focus on because they do require considerable resource utilization and are associated both with significant morbidity and even mortality. Typically, they require either prolonged or re-hospitalization. They often require a surgical procedure to drain and or debride tissue, and they typically require systemic antimicrobial therapy. So again, these generate considerable cost, morbidity, and mortality, and these are now what we're focusing on. If you'll now move on to the next slide, you'll see more recent data reported in this format without risk stratification and excluding superficial surgical site infections. And you'll see remarkably low infection rates from reporting hospitals, and these data do not include all operations performed in the United States, but only data from the 1,000 or so hospitals that have chosen to report. And you see infection rates of generally between 1 and 3%. I particularly draw your attention to colorectal surgery, where complex infections now are believed to occur in about 2.5% of patients. And then coronary bypass grafting done through a sternotomy and hip prosthetic infections, where infection rates are now somewhere between 0.75% and 1%. So these are enviable rates, and an important question that's been raised is whether with infection rates this low, is it really going to be possible to lower them any further? So now I'm going to turn to the guideline, and the next slide provides the title for the current draft guideline for the prevention of surgical site infection. We believe that the final guideline will be published through the internet within approximately 3 to 6 months. The individuals whose names are in black are those people working for CDC, either as employees or contractors. Sandra Berrios-Torres is the orthopedic surgeon and employee of CDC who is responsible for all aspects of this guideline. The individuals in green are part of the team directed by Craig Umscheid, that did the systematic review and the grade review, which I'll come back to in just a minute. That review formed the basis for the recommendations in the core guideline. The other individuals, particularly those in blue and those in red, are surgeons, and it was an important goal put into the design of this guideline that the people that are most directly involved in this, that is the surgeons performing these procedures, be prominently included as external experts. Those in blue are general surgeons, those in red are orthopedic surgeons. And finally, infection control people form a very important user group for these guidelines. And they were represented by those in purple, including the Association of OR Nurses, Epidemiology Societies, Jan Kleitman and Ron Donlan. And then the whole guideline was sponsored by and approved by the Healthcare Infection Control Practices Advisory Committee, which directs the CDC in the generation of this and other guidelines. So if you go to the next graphic, you'll see the home page for the GRADE working group. GRADE stands for the grading of recommendations, assessment, development, and evaluation, and describes the working group. And this began, as I mentioned, in the year 2000, and it generated basically a system for going through the literature, looking at published clinical trials, both randomized and observational, and actually providing a grade, a score for the quality of the evidence. And this system is now used for guidelines developed but not only by the U.S. government, but the Infectious Disease Society of America, the Society of Critical Care Medicine, cardiology groups, gastroenterology groups, and generally most groups developing guidelines for clinical care. And this is a highlight of the URL for the GRADE working group, where you can find considerable information on this system. So basically, recommendations under this system are divided into at least five categories. Category 1A is a very strong recommendation supported by high to moderate quality evidence that suggests benefits or harm. I would point out that for the CDC review, this should be viewed much more as a regulatory document than as a clinical practice directive. The implication of that difference is that the level of evidence needed for a government dictate, meaning essentially as it's applied in the United States, that there will be economic penalties imposed by the government if these guidelines are not followed. So the implication of that is that the evidence has to be very strong that an act should be, that a specific recommendation, a specific action be followed or abandoned. And it may well be in clinical practice settings, for example, generated by clinical practice organizations, may use less of a standard and may use a standard where it's possible that within several years the recommendation may actually change. So it's important to understand the recommendations, that the recommendations in the CDC guideline have to have a very high level of evidence to support them because they have policy implications for the government. So 1B is a strong recommendation that is supported by lower quality evidence, but it is an accepted clinical practice. For example, there has not been a randomized trial of the use of aseptic or sterile technique, but this is broadly practiced and there's a very high level of confidence in the benefits of this. Category 2, there are a few recommendations I'll show you that are weak recommendations, there are a series of other questions where the evidence was not strong enough, again being viewed from a policy level, to make a specific recommendation, and I will show these to you. So if we move to the next slide, these are going to be guideline elements that have to do with preoperative care. So the first one listed is that patients should be advised to shower or bathe with either soap, and whether or not it contains an antimicrobial has been found to be unimportant in very well-done randomized trials. And this bathing should occur the night before the operation. At the time when the patient's in the operating room, intraoperative skin preparation should be done with an alcohol-based antiseptic. And there are certain contraindications based on the location and also the risk of potential toxicity of the compounds and even fire. And the use of an alcohol-based antiseptic, be it chlorhexidine with alcohol, betadine with alcohol, or some other antiseptic. The nature of the antiseptic is not as important as whether or not it's alcohol-based. A Category 2 recommendation is that it is not necessary to use adhesive drapes with or without antimicrobial properties to prevent surgical site infections. Moving on to the next graphic are the recommendations dealing with antibiotic prophylaxis. Optimal, the first one is that the timing of antibiotics for the cephalosporins and other beta-lactams commonly used, the infusion should be begun within 60 minutes of the incision. There is a belief, but there is not much evidence indicating the shortest time before incision, but most people believe antibiotics should be given no sooner than 30 minutes prior to infusion. So again, the 1B strong recommendation is for beginning antibiotics 60 minutes prior to incision. There's been a great deal of interest, particularly within the pharmacy community, to adjust the dose based upon actual body weight. However, there is insufficient data, particularly data looking at reduced surgical site infection rates, to support any recommendation regarding dosage adjustments. The other issue for which there is insufficient clinical outcomes data has to do with whether or not antibiotics should be redosed at every 1 to 2 half-lives. And then the most important recommendation, I think, in this group and the important change in clinical practice is that in clean contaminated procedures, there is a strong Category 1A recommendation that prophylactic parenteral antimicrobial agents should not be administered after the incision is closed in the operating room. And this is different than clinical practice, particularly in orthopedic surgery and particularly following both joint replacement and then cardiac surgery. So the next graphic has to do with what substances to put in or on the wound. There is relatively weak evidence that intraoperative irrigation immediately prior to wound closure with aqueous iodophores may reduce surgical site infection. This is, however, relatively weak evidence. Further, there is similar level of evidence that intraperitoneal lavage in contaminated or dirty, meaning infected, abdominal procedures is not necessary, even though some surgeons continue to practice this. There is another Category 2 statement that it is not necessary to use antimicrobial-coated sutures. This is a subject of current research, and this recommendation as a Category 2 may change in future versions of this. And then finally, there's a rather strong Category 1B recommendation to not apply antimicrobial agents, be they ointments, solutions, or powders, to the surgical incision to prevent surgical site infection. This also is not uncommonly done by some surgeons, and there is very good evidence and solid evidence that there is no benefit to this practice. There are other recommendations that I want to draw your attention to really have to do with what you might call the physiology of surgery. Firstly, it is important to keep blood glucose levels under control, and for this guideline, was believed to be Category 1A evidence to reduce this, to keep glucose under 200 milligrams per deciliter in both diabetic and non-diabetic patients. The other point is to maintain perioperative normothermia. And this is, again, a very strong Category 1A recommendation. The guideline does not provide a target temperature, nor does it recommend specific devices or techniques that can be used to do this. And then the final recommendation has to do with providing oxygen to those patients being managed for general anesthesia with endotracheal intubation. And they should receive an increased fraction of inspired oxygen intraoperatively and then in the immediate postoperative period after extubation. It is also important to maintain adequate volume to maintain perfusion. The normothermia and oxygen recommendations really are intended to provide optimal perfusion to the surgical wound, and an important component of this is adequate volume replacement. So I want to just conclude my talk by showing you what we've been doing in the United States, which it will be changing over the next few years, to translate these recommendations into government policy. And this has been done and is being done through the so-called Surgical Care Improvement Project. And this includes several modules, the infection prevention module you see listed here, appropriate prophylactic antibiotics, appropriate hair removal, normothermia, maintain and carefully controlled serum glucose, particularly in cardiac surgery patients. So as of January of this year, for each patient in the United States undergoing operation in hospitals, the hospital is required to report to the government if SCIP measures were met. If the hospitals have less than 90% compliance, payment from the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services is reduced by 1-3%. I would point out two facts to you. One is that in the United States, the federal government pays for 60-70% of health care, and a reduction in payment from CMS by 1-3% is actually the operating profit margin for most hospitals and is therefore a very significant number. And this is a very strong incentive for hospitals, for hospital administrators, physicians, nurses, and other personnel to ensure compliance with the SCIP measures. Additionally, these compliance rates are reported to the public through the Internet, which in the U.S. has been found to be a very powerful tool. In the next slide, you see an attempt in answering the question of what has compliance with SCIP measures resulted in. And this is graphics actually from a VA hospital, which is a subset of hospitals within the United States, that looks at infection rates from 2005 through 2010 and similarly looks at compliance with various SCIP measures. So the first point, the solid black line, indicates compliance with the SCIP measures, and you can see that it now is up to 90%. the right axis provides the surgical site infection rate. And you can see that through time, as compliance has greatly increased for the composite, meaning all of the variables I mentioned, there has been at best a modest decrease in infection rates. So the question is, how is this explained? And I think it's explained by looking at the antibiotic variables. And what you see is that the appropriate choice of antibiotics, the timely administration of these antibiotics, and the discontinuation of these antibiotics, which is less significant, I think, than the timely administration and drug choice, that these were at very high levels, greater than 90% or close to 90% throughout the study interval. And what this suggests is that the antibiotic prophylaxis has an enormous effect on infection rates and may actually prevent infections that would be seen and were seen in carefully controlled trials with variables when variables such as hair removal are not carefully controlled. So I think this graphic basically says that we're firstly doing rather well, and that secondly, that antibiotic prophylaxis and attention particularly to the choice of agents and the timing of prophylaxis may be the most significant variable within the surgical care improvement program. So I want to just conclude then with some comments which you see on the next graphic on the WHO perspective. So firstly, there is clear evidence that evidence-based guidelines really are required, and that actually in recent surveys guidelines in various countries, many countries are found not to have up-to-date or recent guidelines, and certainly then this WHO SSI prevention guideline will be welcome in many countries. And I would point out that this is a global document and is not aimed specifically at low, middle, or even high-income countries. The important point, though, despite the recommendations that will be made, is that I think an important focus for all guidelines, and particularly the WHO guideline, really comes down to a very strong commitment to implementation and to the development both of implementation strategies and surveillance, both at an international, national, and regional, and even hospital level. And the development of appropriate implementation tools at the hospital and even unit level is an important part of the entire guideline development process. And then finally, I want to just stress that risk models indeed are needed to monitor performance, and that particularly when we begin country by country or region by region comparisons, we need these kinds of models to understand what actions may be required to further reduce infections. And this is complicated both by resource availability, disease patterns, medical training, et cetera. So I would say again that I think that the development of appropriate risk models is a critical part of this. And conclude then, and these are comments that really have more to do with the WHO guideline than with the CDC, is that the absence of data makes planning recommendations difficult. And I think an important part, as I mentioned, of any activity in this area of preventing developing strategies to reduce surgical site infections depends upon data on what procedures are performed, what the risks are for those patients possibly becoming infected. And this will define what recommendations should be made and which should be focused upon. It's not easy to extrapolate data, for example, from the United States or other high-income countries where most of the procedures we do are clean or clean contaminated and elective, to other low or middle income countries where much more of the surgery is done on an emergency basis and may involve other risk factors. And the other point that the CDC made in structuring the guideline is that surgical champions really are central to the implementation of whatever recommendations are developed. And my own bias in what we're doing with the WHO guideline is involving surgeons who are interested in this particular problem and the development of the recommendations and then in the implementation strategies. And with that, I'll quit, and I will thank you very much for your attention. And I would further point out and restate that if you're interested in either asking me questions, you can email or getting these slides, you can email me directly at jsalomkin@isis-group.org. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Joe, for giving such an excellent presentation. And at the end, I would like to thank all the audience who came over and listened to this teleconference. And I just want to remind you that please do not forget to join us on our special teleconference of WHO, which is on 5th of May. And as you know, 5th of May is WHO Global Hand Hygiene Day. And this presentation, which is very special, will be delivered by Professor Didier Pittet from University Hospital in Geneva. And with that, I thank the speakers and all the people who have participated in the teleconference. Thank you very much, and have a good day. Thank you. Goodbye.